question. Sig, you had a question.
I've heard people that are in the field you're in that have traveled around the world, come back. In fact, a friend of mine who was a Vietnam veteran went back to Vietnam, came back. He was with a group from NATO, and their thought was that maybe democracy doesn't work in other parts of the world. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on, does democracy work other places, or is it, you said about the free people or the minority being
protected.
Yeah, I made the strong point, and it's not my point. Adlai Stevenson made it many years ago, that democracy is not just when the majority win an election and rule, but when the rights of the minority are protected, which is what makes America so great, that those minority groups are protected, and the majority works overtime to protect minority groups in this country, which isn't the case in other places. There's another factor, of course, that rides into this very, very heavily, and why it becomes almost impossible for some countries to have democracies, and this is a horrible thing to say, is because they are too religious. Religion almost tends towards a theocracy. And there are people in this country who would love to create a theocracy, who would like to, in fact, say, this is what the Bible teaches, and we're going to impose God's law on everybody else in the society. Indeed, there is a whole movement in this country called the Christian Reconstruction Movement that really believes that America will never be the country it ought to be until the teachings of society as outlined in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, become the law of the land. Certainly over in Iran, the Ayatollahs control the country. When those who rule believe that they are ruling by the divine right, that they have God's ordination, then it becomes very, very difficult for them to accede the rights of a minority group. They look at the minority group as, quote unquote, not simply anti the ruling establishment, but anti-God. The United States comes very close to that at times. When we begin to say, this is a Christian nation, you've heard certain Christians say, this is a Christian nation. It's really not. It never was. We have always maintained separation as church and state. To be sure, when this country was founded, according to some statistical analyses, less than 15% of the entire American population belonged to any church at all. We believe that, you know, America was made up of all these God people. Listen, they emptied the prisons of England. They brought over the, you know, a lot of bad people to this country. The good people didn't arrive until the Italians started coming about. No, I'm just joking. You know I'm just joking.
Yeah, right.
The reality is that this was not a particularly religious country when it was founded. The founders of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were not necessarily religious people. There were religious people in there. As a matter of fact, there were a few clergy persons who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But you had secularists. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was hardly a member of the God Squad. You know, Jefferson doesn't exactly have a pristine... And incidentally, if you really want to study something interesting, if you go back to that era and read about Jefferson and read the Jeffersonian papers, you will find that they were fighting the same fight back there that they're fighting now. Namely, the religious right was trying to take over the country, and Jefferson became the crusader to stand up against it. So whenever a governing body begins to believe that it is there by divine right, it becomes very difficult to have a democracy, for obvious reason. To oppose the government is to oppose God. It makes, in fact, the suppression of minorities religiously legitimate. So in countries where intense religion pervades, democracy is hard to come by. So Muslim countries are a case in point. If you were to go to Malaysia, I've been to Malaysia. It's a beautiful country and it's a wonderful country. But Christians do not have the same rights as Muslims, i.e., it's all right for the Muslims to convert Christians to their faith. But if a Muslim becomes a Christian, there are very serious penalties that are exercised. That's hardly a democracy. Now, they'll say they have a democracy because they have a free election. But the Christians do not have a fair opportunity there as they do here in this country. So my answer to your question is, yes, there are many countries in the world where democracy won't work because they verge on theocracies. And that makes it almost impossible to have a democracy.
Does it then make it difficult for us to get out of Iraq?
No, I think...
Because it may not be stable without the military presence? Or?
Well, I don't know. Will it be good or will it not be good? I have no way of knowing. We do know that where the U.S. and British troops have left, that there's great stability, i.e. the only place that's really secure right now is where the British have left, in the south of Iraq. They're gone. And granted, the guy that took over is a guy named Sadr, and I mean, he's a totalitarian mullah of a high Muslim mindsets, but the violence has ended. Yeah, so theocracies can be very stable. I mean, they may be the most stable forms of government of all. To believe that the king rules by divine right gives tremendous, what we call in sociology, legitimation to the ruling establishment. See, for an establishment to rule, the people have to say they have a legitimate right to make the demands that they do. You can see when that ruling group is religious and understands itself in religious terms, and all the people say they have a right to be this way, it's hard to maintain a democracy. Yeah. Any other questions that you have? Okay. I want to pick up on the church as a lead society. I want to pick up on the church as a lead institution in society, how the church can actually be very, very effective in bringing about social change. In the book that you're going to be reading in this course, A Revolution Renewal, How Churches Are Saving the City, you will find there are a whole host of things that the church can do. And they can enter into politics. They can enter into business. They can enter into education. They can enter into every sector of the society and affect positive social change. In a pluralistic society, we must do so always respecting the rights of minorities. So when people say to me, how do you feel about prayer and Bible reading in public school? My answer is, I think taking Bible reading and prayer out of the public school was a good idea. Why? Because we're a pluralistic society. What happens in Utah, where the dominant population is Mormon? Do Christian kids have to sit there and listen to the Book of Mormon being read? What about in Hawaii, where certain communities are overwhelmingly Buddhist? Do kids have to sit there and listen to the Upanishads? Whose prayer, whose scripture are we going to read? Does the local community have the right to decide this? And if it does, what happens to the minority, you see? And people will say, you know, it's only a handful of people in that school that oppose this. Exactly. And in a democracy, we make concessions to just a handful of people. And the majority has to, in fact, say this is the price you pay if you're going to live in a pluralistic democratic society, that, in fact, we may have to make concessions to minorities that we may not want to make. But we can invade every sector of society. Incidentally, there are all kinds of things that churches can do. One of the most effective, which I have not seen done in any specific way, is this. Should you become a worker in an inner city church or a faith-based social service agency, you know, a settlement house of some sort, and you really want to impact the educational system, here's what you should do. And the first thing that comes to mind is, let's set up tutoring. That's good. That's not the best thing to do. The best thing to do is to go down to the high school and say, we want to help rejuvenate the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association of this school. West Philadelphia High, my old high school, has a PTA organization. The largest crowd that ever showed up for a PTA meeting, according to my last report, was 15. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students, 15 parents show up. What if we could get 500 or 600 parents show up? What if the church stepped in and said to the principal, I know you don't have time for this, but what we'd like to do is really work hard on getting people out to the PTA meetings. And the PTA isn't going to just sell candy bars in order to get new uniforms for the girls basketball team. What we're going to do is we're going to make the PTA into the kind of thing that exists in the suburbs. Man, the Radnor Township PTA. I mean, I'd rather be in the political field rather than in the school board. I mean, these kids, people come in and they demand this for their students and they demand that. And you know what the biggest complaint is in Radnor Township? That the kids don't get enough homework. You know, you got to work them harder. You know, we want our kids to get into Harvard, into Princeton, into Yale, and you're not pushing them hard enough. And you need to get them read more and study more. Gee whiz, you say, holy mackerel, what is it with these people? And the parents show up and they're on the teachers. And if a teacher isn't doing a good job, the parents are all over the school and all over the teacher. To get parents involved in the education of their children is very important. And then beyond that, let me say this. If you can then move from that to getting the parents to set up a tutoring center rather than the church doing it. Why? Because all the studies will reveal the following. And you know this to be true. One minute I say it, you say, I didn't need a study. But the studies have been done. Here's what the case is. If you get a bunch of college students or university students to go in and tutor kids in the inner city, their academic achievement will rise dramatically. Eastern University, this school, requires every student in his freshman year to spend the first semester as a tutor in inner city schools. They carry them into Philadelphia, and they set them up in schools, and they tutor kids after school hours. So every student here has to do that. Every student is required to do that. If you want to volunteer after that, and many do, that's fine, but you have to do it your first semester because it's a requirement. That's wonderful, and the effects are obvious. You can trace the improvement in the students' academic achievement. However, if the tutors, rather than being university students, are the parents of the kids, they don't just improve, they go off the charts. It is dramatic, the difference when parents become involved in tutoring their own kids, in being there in the basement of that church or wherever you're holding the tutoring session, and the parents of the kids, real-life parents are there. It has a totally different effect and a much more positive effect on the academic achievements of the kids. To get church people involved in the education of the students is crucial. It seems to me that the church has done a great deal to hurt public education, especially in the city. If you were to go into Philadelphia, you would find that it's one of the most segregated school systems in America. Because what happened is that the brightest and the best kids from the wealthiest families are pulled out of the public school system and put into private schools. Catholic schools, but there's a whole network of other schools. A lot of churches set up their own schools. And these become ways of disengaging Christian people and the best kids from the school system. And so the school system goes into decline because we're disengaging Christian parents and Christian kids increasingly from the educational experiences that are going on within the high schools and the junior highs and the elementary schools of the inner city. EAPE, that's our organization. You'll hear a lot about it in this course, the Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education. It started some 30-some years ago here at the college, and we have extensive work, which we'll talk about from time to time, in 9 different cities across the United States. And we have tutoring programs. We started schools. We have all kinds of inner-city economic development programs. We're in everything you can think of when it comes to urban work. But the reality is that this organization is really committed to public education. We run a Christian school. We run 3 Christian schools, as a matter of fact. But we think that the Christian church ought to be going to the school system and saying, we want the kids who are falling between the cracks. We want your problem children. We want your problem teenagers. We want the kids that you wish you could expel. We want the dregs. Why? Because we are the church. And we take the, quote, the stones which the builders reject, and we build a kingdom. We take the stones which the builders reject, and we build a kingdom. And we should say that's what the church should be doing. It ought to be stepping forward and picking up those who fall between the cracks. Instead, we're siphoning off the best families and the best children from engagement in the public school system. A lot of people really give the public school system a hard time. And I got to tell you, it's evil. Because I have to tell you, it's a different game than when I went to school. When I went to school, the worst thing that could happen to you is if your mother came to school. I mean, if the teacher said, if you keep this up, Tony, I'm going to send a note home, and I'm going to have your mother come in here. You knew, you could just see the tombstone. Here lies Tony Campolo. Domestic trouble cited as cause of death. I mean, I'm dead meat. And after my mother finished with me, my father would start on me. And it was before they got rid of all of this physical punishment of kids. I'm Italian, man. I got physically punished. I mean physically punished. I mean, so I didn't mess. If the teacher said I was going to bring you, that was the worst thing that could happen. Now, if the word is that a mother is coming to school, it's not the kid that's afraid. It's the teacher's going to afraid. The teacher's going to get reeled out by the parent. The parent will take, in most cases, takes the side of the student instead of taking the side of the teacher. These are difficult roles to play where you're trying to educate kids and their own parents are out to get you. In many instances, this is the way it is in the inner city school situation. So be careful as you attack public schools and recognize this, that there's so much you can do in a public school. For instance, you can have clubs that meet after school that do Bible study and have an evangelistic work. There's nothing to stop you from that. As a matter of fact, President Clinton made sure that that was written into law. It was a public access law where church groups could really use school buildings for their meetings. The argument was everybody else is allowed to use them. If the local witchcraft group wants to use the building, that's okay. Why not the church? And what the law really says, just so that you get it clearly, is this, that no paid employee of the school system can exercise any leadership in religious activity. In other words, nobody's saying you can't have prayer in the public school. Nobody's saying you can't read the Bible in the public school. What we are saying is the school cannot write out the prayer and provide it, number one. And number two is no teacher or janitor or anybody that works in the school system is allowed to perform the religious practice. Why? Because everybody in the community is paying this person's salary. The Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, the atheists, the agnostics, everybody's paying this person's salary. So if everybody's paying this person's salary, what right does that person have to favor one religion over another, do you see? You can see the logic in this, can't you? Why should an atheist have to pay to have the Bible read by somebody who is, quote unquote, in a sense, his employee or her employee? That's the reasoning. There is nothing to stop a kid from reading the Bible and praying. So, in fact, this can happen. A high school student can stand up and say to the teacher, Miss Jones or Mr. Smith, before class starts today, there's a passage of scripture I would like to read to you. The kid is not a public employee. You say, well, how's the Muslim kid feel about it? Easy. There's nothing to stop him to say, well, if he's going to read the Bible, I would like to read a section from the Quran. And the agnostic kid says, I think I want to read a little bit from Bertrand Russell and why in the book, Why I Am Not a Christian. That's the actual title of the book. And you say, man, this would be a religious free-for-all. I think it would be terrific. I think that's what's wrong with us, that we don't know anything about anybody else's religion other than our own. We don't know much about our own, but we certainly don't know much about the others. And to have people sharing what they believe, that's freedom of speech, you see. And so the freedom of speech thing makes it possible for students who are not paid by the taxpayers to speak out. You can see the logic of the argument. And what happens is that certain religious fanatics yell and scream and say they've taken the Bible out of the public school. And personally, you know, I always get a little irritated by the prayer thing. When I was in high school, I was good friends with two guys. They were both brilliant track people. I ran track, but I wasn't very good. And I ran track for one reason. I wanted to play on the basketball team. And in our high school, you either had to go for cross country or track in order to get physically in shape for basketball, see? You can see the logic and build up your running skills. And I tried cross country, but I didn't like vomiting at the end of the race. So I ran track, and the shortest distance is the 100 yards. And I wasn't that fast. I was the slowest guy on the team. One guy that runs the individual, and four guys run the relay. And I was on the relay team. That was enough. That got me on the basketball team. That was fine. Until we got to the city championship. And there were two guys that were brilliant. Just brilliant. One was Bo Robertson, who won a silver medal in the Olympics, which gives you some idea as to his effectiveness. And another one was Frank Robinson, who was equally as good. Both of them went to the Mount Carmel Baptist Church. And I knew them, and they were friends of mine. And we would practice, and they would always beat the daylights out of me. 100 yards, they'd be like 8, 9, 10 yards ahead of me. When it came to the city championship, they decided to pull our best runner out of the individual and put him on the relay team. Thinking what? We can't win the individual anyway, so let's take our worst runner, Tampolo, and put him in with the individuals. And so Campolo got the word that I would be running against the best 100-yard dash people in the city because they were pulling the guy that usually runs a 100-yard dash and making him the anchor man for the relay team. You can see their logic. It was good coaching. But I had to run against these guys. And I got at the lining. I still remember because we had worked our way. Our position was determined by how we did during the season. And we had earned a place in the finals during the season. So I'm in the finals. And I'm lining up, and you know I'm going to get eaten alive. And they take off. And in those days, they didn't have these nice sneakers, and they had cinder tracks. They had cinder tracks, and you had spiked shoes, which meant in the 100-yard dash, if you got 5 or 6 yards behind anybody, they were kicking up cinders in your face. Needless to say, I ate cinders the whole last 50 yards of that race. Crossed the finish line, and Bo is being interviewed by the press because he has just set a new schoolboy record. And Frank and I, both Christians, all three of us Christians, standing there on the side listening to this, and Bo says, are you ready for this? I want to thank the Lord for the victory today. It was God that gave me this victory, and all the glory belongs to him. And Frank said to me, hey, Tony, what's God got against us? It's a good question. You know, I mean, that prayer stuff always, I mean, the guy runs down the field, knocks over three people on the way to the goal line. Two of them are left unconscious. And when he crosses the line, he goes, well, thank you, Jesus. You know, you say, I don't like this. No wonder the Bible says, if you're going to do your praying, what? Go into the closet and shut the door. And the God who sees what you do in secret will reward you openly. I am sick and tired of public displays of religiosity because Jesus is against it. There's a good line. Jesus. You can't beat Jesus if you're going to talk about Christianity. I think he has more authority than most of the rest of us. Agreed? Anybody disagree with that? Okay. Let's talk about the church in terms of economic development, because a lot of you are into economic development as graduate students. Here at Eastern, we have this graduate program that is preparing people for economic development among the poor. We've been turning out scores and scores of people who have worked in the third world. Most of them go to work with Opportunity International, an organization that over the last 20 years has created micro-businesses in the third world through microfinance. And they have generated, they say, somewhere around 3.5 million jobs. They are expecting to have created 100 million jobs within the next 10 years. We're talking about eliminating poverty on a massive level here. Micro businesses. The first business we ever created was in the Dominican Republic. It was a neat business. We were making sandals out of worn-out, discarded automobile tires. We gave the boys and girls in the slum area called Guachapita 50 cents every time they brought us a worn-out, discarded automobile tire. It wasn't long before we had every worn-out, discarded automobile tire in Santo Domingo. Then we started getting a lot of new automobile tires. Do you believe in a God that works in mysterious ways? His wonders to perform. We had to obviously change our modus operandi. But we had created jobs. And over the years, starting small micro businesses, small micro industries, we have in fact created about 3.5 million jobs through Opportunity International. That's a lot of jobs. This little school that not many people know about has probably done more to affect the alleviation of poverty in the third world than big universities. It's quite remarkable what the students have done. I was at their convention just a few days ago down in Florida, and it was incredible. I mean, it was like there were four ambassadors there. People from the World Bank come, I mean, because they're just amazed at what's happening. And it was one Eastern student after another that was leading the presentations, and they were magnificent. Microeconomic development in the third world. What we have come to realize is that you don't have to go to the third world to go to the third world anymore. The third world is right here in our own cities. There is hardly a city in the world that doesn't have a third world situation, a culture of poverty, a beaten down people, the same circumstances, the same situations that you will find in the slums of Santo Domingo, in the slums of Philippines, you'll find in some sections of most cities in America. And the question is, if you do so well at creating job opportunities for people in the third world, when are you going to start doing it for people here in the United States? Please note that if you were to go into the city, you would find that there's a big problem there, big problem. And that is that you ride around in the city and you see these groups of young men standing on the street corner. They don't have anything to do. They're wasting away. It's sad to see this wasting humanity on the street corners. And you can't drive around a city for any length of time without passing street corner after street corner after street corner where this is the case. These young men probably have dropped out of school. They probably are functionally illiterate. They don't know how to run a computer. They don't know how to do anything that would enable them to get the kind of employment that is available in the newspaper. This all came to me very clearly. We were running an inner city program in West Philadelphia in a really beat up, battered housing development that now has been completely redeveloped. But back when we started our work, it was the hellhole. It was called Pasayunk Homes. And it was a government housing project made out of cinder block during World War II to house the naval personnel out of the Philadelphia Navy Yard. And when the war ended, there wasn't any housing, so they simply turned these barracks into government housing units, and they looked like barracks, and it was horrible. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these units. And, we were working in there, and what we do is recruit people from schools like Harding and say, hey, we still do this, incidentally, so you need to consider this. How about coming and working with us for the summer? How about coming and give us your summer? We'll put you to work in a very difficult neighborhood. You'll live together in community. We'll get a place for you to live and 8, 9, 10 of you into a house, and you'll cook your own food. And you'll go out and work with a couple of hundred kids, and you'll play games and teach Bible and do cultural enrichment stuff, take them on cultural trips. And then in the afternoon, you'll do individual one-on-one relational ministry. In the evening, you'll work with teenagers. We'll wear you out for about 7 weeks. Just wear you out. We'll not let up on you for a minute. And you'll have a great time. And you'll go through pain and agony, and you'll come away saying, these were the best 7 weeks of my life. So we recruit these people. The problem is that universities and colleges have changed their school years. It used to be, when I went to school, you never went to school in the fall until after Labor Day. When it was that way with you, Sig, wasn't it? You didn't go back to school until about the 10th or 11th, sometimes the middle of September. You just you know, that's the way it was. Now, you have to return, like, the last week of August, they have classes.
Is that the way it is at Harding as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's stupid. Because what it means is that everybody has to go back to school earlier and earlier and earlier. And when you're working with inner city kids in this government housing project, and we were working with 10 different housing projects in the city, and that we lost almost our entire work staff because they were all university student volunteers. They all disappeared in the last couple of weeks of August. Solution. I called every Christian camp within miles of Philadelphia and said, I've got a bunch of kids. We've had them all summer, but the last 2 weeks, we don't have anybody to watch over them. Would you be willing to take these kids for a couple of weeks free of charge? We got tremendous responses, Got one camp, a Young Life camp down in North Carolina. It's a wonderful place. They have motorbikes, they have swimming pools. I mean, this is the country club camp of all camps. Do you know anything about Young Life? It's an upper middle class Christian movement. I mean, that's who they really hit. They're beginning to hit the inner city for the first time, but for the most part, it's that suburban school that has the Young Life Club. So they had this wonderful place. And they sent up a video that I could show the kids of how wonderful. And these inner city kids in Pasadena Commons are going, hey, man, this is cool, man. We're going to go. And then they added this. But we think to just give people something when they don't have to pay anything for it minimizes the value of the thing. So we're not going to ask for much, $25 a week. Your young people ought to be able to come up with $25 for a week for 2 weeks. You ought to come up with $50. They got the whole summer to get the money. I got the kids together and, yeah, we are going to do this. We're really going to do it. Well, the time came for them to go. Every kid showed up with $50 in his hand. We collected the 50 bucks a piece, put them on the bus. They took off. 2 days later, I get a call from the police department. So there's a whole row of cars, stolen cars, out behind Passion Combs. Got a whole row of cars out there. They're all stolen. They've been stripped. And we know that the stuff was fenced. And we know who did it. It was your kids. And they stole the cars and stripped the cars in order to get money to go to church camp. I was so depressed. And he said, no, you know, you're taking this wrong. You've made great progress. I said, progress? All summer we're telling them about Jesus, and this is what they do? He said, hey, man, they always stole cars and stripped them. They always stole cars and fenced the stuff. Don't you think this is a vast improvement? I began to feel better immediately. He said, well, you've solved half the problem. You've got them spending the money in a positive manner. What you've got to do is get them to earn the money in a positive manner. Robert Merton, one of the deans of American sociology, laid out this theme. If a society prescribes goals that every member of the society should achieve, and then does not provide socially acceptable ways of reaching those goals, Merton contends that the people will choose illegal means to reach the goals. Ours is a weird society. We have this thing called television. It didn't exist in my day. When I was growing up, they didn't have television. The net result is that every kid in America is socialized via television to want exactly the same things. He wants the same toys, the same sneaks, the same clothes, the same everything. They are all socialized to the same goals. But you take one segment of the society, namely inner city kids, particularly ethnically oppressed groups of kids, and you deny them legitimate means for reaching those goals. You know what's going to happen. They still have the same goals. They've just changed the means of achieving the goals. Namely, they steal. Is it any wonder that there's so much that goes on in this way? When the kids came back from the camp, I waited until they came back. got him into the rec room, sat him down, about 50 of them. They knew what was coming, their heads were down. And I read the riot act to them. And finally I said, and I shouldn't have said this, what do you got to say for yourselves? One kid said, well, what did you think we were going to do? I said, I thought you were going to get the money a good way. What did you think we were going to get the money? I said, I thought you were going to work for it. The kid said, work, work. Do you know how much work it was to steal those cars, to strip those cars, to fence that stuff? We worked hard, didn't we? Oh, because, man, we worked hard. They're all, yeah, we worked hard. Of course they worked hard. It is hard to steal cars and strip them and fence the stuff. It's hard. It's just not legitimate work. And if the church doesn't like illegitimate work, and stealing is work, it's about time we recognize that. When we talk about value-free sociology, that's what we mean by value-free. You say stealing, it's wrong. Get rid of the value. It's a means of making money. That's the way the sociology, it's functional. It works. It fits in with the system. Point. If you don't like it, you got to create legitimate means for earning money. Now, I have to ask you a very simple question. When there were no schools, who created the schools? The church. When there were no hospitals, who created hospitals? The church. When there are no recreational facilities, who created the YMCAs? The church. The church always responded to the needs of the community. If you get into social work or social ministry in the inner city and you do what they teach you to do at the school, you go into the community and you gather the people together and say, I am here in the name of Jesus to meet your needs. And they told me at Eastern that the first thing I must do is listen and let you tell us what your needs are. Isn't that good progressive social work theory? Listen to the people. And they say, well, to tell the truth, what we really need are some jobs. Great. So what happens? You come back and you set up a basketball league. That's what we do. And we come back the next month for another meeting. We're here to meet your needs in the name of Jesus. What are your needs? We need jobs. We set up a counseling center. We come back the next month and we say, what do you need? We need jobs. We set up a parenting program. At a particular point, they're going to say, these people are not listening. You say, well, why do we do that? For the very simple reason. We teach you people who are going into social ministries how to do everything except how to create jobs. So you do what you've been trained to do. Bishop Roland Martin, Roland Williams, rather, of the United Kingdom, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said one Christmas he was given a screwdriver because that's what he wanted for a present for Christmas. He said, you know what I did? For the next month, I went around tightening every screw that I could find. Wherever there was a screw, I would tighten it. Namely, I did what the tool I had equipped me to do, whether it needed it or not. What happens is we give you tools to work with, and you'll use those tools whether there's any need for them at all. You'll use them. And that's what happens. And so we teach you how to set up a recreational program, and we teach you how to set up a counseling center, and we tell you how to set up a financial advisory counseling center, and we teach you all these things, and you say, wow, I'm equipped, but you didn't hear it. They want jobs. And so the question is the church going to respond and create jobs? That's why I like teaching at Eastern. Because some 25 years ago, we started this economic development program because we recognize that when it's all said and done, you got to create jobs. There's no way of eliminating poverty except by creating jobs. There's no other way. There's no other way. That's why the Bible said, as I said earlier, that in the kingdom, everyone will have a job in the vineyard. Everybody will have a job because you can't escape poverty any other way. I work heavily for Compassion International, recruiting people who are willing to support children in the third world. And it's wonderful. For $32 a month, you can clothe, you can educate, you can deliver the whole ball of wax to a kid in a third world country. But what if you don't create any job for that kid? It's not going to get them out of poverty. It'll get them through his childhood, but it won't get him out of poverty. Actually, our missionary organization, the Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education, our very first project was to start a university in the Dominican Republic. And it was a good university, a really good university. You say, whoa, that's ambitious. You know, because this was in the late 50s, early 60s. We're getting into gear here. And the idea at that time was education is the means to help people out of poverty. If we can just educate people, we'll get them out of poverty. You heard the line, if you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. If you teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. We believe that. We didn't ask the obvious question. What if after you teach this guy how to fish, he doesn't have a pond in which to fish? He doesn't have a place to do his fishing. Now what you've done is raised him to a high level of frustration because he spent all his time preparing to do something that he can't do because there's no pond in which to fish. What happens if you educate a guy or you educate a woman and that person after graduation can find no place to put his or her skills to work? I took all this time to learn these skills at the school and now there's nobody that wants to hire me. I know what you're going to do. If you're in the Dominican Republic, I know what you're going to do. You're going to figure there are no jobs available for educated people here in my country, but there are in the United States. If you don't think if you don't get what I'm driving at, go down to the local hospital, any hospital, and ask how many of the doctors there are from other countries. How many of the interns there are from other countries? They're from India, they're from Latin America, they're from all over the place. And they all want to come here, and they all want to work in the hospitals, and they all eventually want to stay here. We exercise a brain drain to educate people for jobs that don't exist. In third world countries, only exercises a brain drain. In the United States, it becomes a different kind of problem. In the United States, we have these people who are not educated. And if we don't educate them, what are we going to do? How are we going to help them? How are we going to enable them to escape from their poverty? The answer is the church can create jobs. Let me tell you what the church has going for it. First of all, it has a building that sits there all week long. Right? I mean, they use it on Sunday. They might use it during the week for a meeting or two. But basically, church buildings sit there, unused. It's the greatest waste of real estate in the world. Think of all those buildings sitting there doing nothing. You talk about cost effectiveness. Building a church building has got to be the least effective use of money you can think of. Sanctuary is going to be used an hour on Sunday morning. Sunday school rooms that you build are 45 minutes a week. All this space, what's going to happen here? It's obvious that if you know how to do it, and that's what we teach you to do in this economic development program here, if you know how to do it, you can establish businesses in that church building without losing the tax-exempt status of the church. There are ways of doing it. It can be done. We figured it out. You see, it's always the big corporations that get tax lawyers to say, how can we beat the system? Well, here at Eastern, we got tax lawyers and said, how can we beat the system? For the kingdom of God, of course. And so, in fact, this is what happened. We figured out how to do that. And you can house micro businesses in a church. Number one. Number two, picking up on a question that was raised earlier. You probably have in that same inner city church people who come to Sunday school and church on Sunday who are retired, who could form a consulting team for this business or businesses. You have accountants. You probably have a lawyer in the group. You probably have people who themselves ran businesses and come with all kinds of expertise. You could easily put that to work. So you got the facilities. You've got the consulting team. Number three is you got the one thing that non-Christian or non-religious groups do not have. And that is you have the ability to change people's consciousness. We're big on this. Consciousness raising has been very much a part of social change ever since the African-American and feminist movements came on the scene. That it's not enough to change the rules and the regulations of the system. You've got to change the thinking of people, the feelings of people, the attitudes of people. You've got to change the way they are.